You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of December 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Paul Osborne. On today's show, a somewhat bizarre pronouncement from Donald Trump. See, some accuse him of venturing dangerously close to fascism. Plus, the Australian Prime Minister's chilly exchange with the nation's public broadcaster.
You know. If every guest on the program came on and they only got to talk about what they wanted to talk about, it would be a very different program.
Now listen, let me ask you this question. How interested do you think your audience are?
Malcolm Turnbull proved slightly more prepared for the famously tough TV host than his prime ministerial predecessor. But just what is the modern etiquette of a hard-hitting political interview? We'll also look at the implications of a big win in Venezuela and wonder whether it's good news for the country's long-term future. All that plus the choking smog of Beijing coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today, Dr. Phil Clark, a lecturer in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London, and Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor of The Times here in London. Welcome both of you to the studio. We will start in the United States. By now, we are used to Donald Trump saying things that appear either bizarre or offensive, or both. But his latest pronouncement was so bizarre and so seemingly offensive that many people thought initially that it was a spoof. But in fact, it is the latest official policy of the Republican presidential frontrunner that Muslims should be banned from entering the United States. Not known extremists or people from specific countries, just Muslims. All of them. Tourists, immigrants, businessmen, businesswomen, all apparently would be banned by President Trump to allow them to, in his words, figure out what is going on. Roger Boyce, you can understand why a lot of people, when this first started to circulate last night, thought that's got to be a spoof.
Yes, and it is in this long comic tradition of Trumpisms, where you don't really know fact from fiction. I mean, what's next? You know, to ban ugly women from America? You know, he really has absolutely no limits. But I do worry. I mean, I'm always worried when businessmen try to become politicians. Usually, almost invariably, it goes wrong. But what I worry about most is that he's actually contaminating the whole process. And so you've got Ted Cruz coming out and saying, well, you know, sort of shrugging his shoulders and saying, well, you know, he's got a point, you know, and the Donald could become my, you know, immigration and trade czar if and when I take over. You know, there's a lot of nastiness that's kind of crawling out, because what we think of as being comic seems utterly logical to a certain Republican constituency that thinks that they are about to face another terrorist attack. And I think that's what underpins it, the idea that, ISIS, the Islamic State, will sooner or later break through with some proper huge attack in the United States. And in fact, it's perfectly logical that they do that. I mean, they're on the ISIS are on the, you know, sharp end of American bombing. So why should they confine themselves to Paris and other places? So something's going on. They're smelling something in the wind, and they think that there's going to be more. It may look ludicrous now, especially to Europeans, these Trumpisms, but actually may seem weirdly and disturbingly prophetic if something really nasty happens in the United States.
Well, we will explore the sort of the wider implications of the Trump candidacy in a little while. But Phil, I just wanted to just look at some of the reactions to what Donald Trump has said. Jeb Bush said he was unhinged. Dick Cheney said that Donald Trump's comments went against everything we stand for as Americans. Now, when Dick Cheney thinks you've gone too far, you're in trouble, aren't you?
You would like to think so. That when the sort of Republican establishment that reacted so violently to 9/11 thinks that you've gone too far, you surely do have a problem. But I guess what's sort of baffling in all of this is, Trump does continue to poll extraordinarily well with everyday Republican voters. It will be interesting to see what the long-term reaction is to this latest comment about Muslims. But his mad comments to date have not exactly deterred the electorate. So he may be putting the sort of Republican establishment off, but it's not entirely clear that he's deterring everyday voters. This kind of Islamophobia does seem to resonate with many everyday Americans, and that's maybe the scariest thing in all of this.
Well, this is what I was interested in, is that we've kept hearing all the way through the Trump candidacy, there's going to be a Trump implosion. He's going to do or say something that's so offensive that will be the end of him as a serious candidate. Now, this could be it. Equally, when the polling numbers come back, if this remark's played well, as you were saying, Roger, this could drag all the other candidates further to the right to try and compete with him.
Yes, I think I don't know how it's going to play out, but one way it might play out is the clash between his business interests and his political ambitions. So, you know, he's got a global property. He's got global property interests, including Indonesia. Well, you know, Indonesia is not exactly free of Muslims. You know, it's there are people who can shrug off his, misogynist views or his views on people with cerebral palsy or all these other distasteful things he's got. But he's doing business with the Muslim world, you know, and what are they going to make of this? And are they going to punish him financially in some way? And when that happens, then we get either a tamer Donald, or an even more ludicrously neo-fascistic Donald. But either way, the game changes slightly, and we will see a slightly different Donald.
This has become a kind of game of chicken, hasn't it, Phil? We've sort of kept saying, how much further can Donald Trump go? And he keeps trying to outdo himself. So this might be the implosion moment, but equally, if there is going to be this mythical stop Trump candidate that we've been hearing is going to emerge and is going to take all of the funding that is so essential for any Republican presidential hopeful, it really ought to make themselves known quite quickly.
Yeah, we've predicted the implosion of Trump on this very program, I think, 8 or 9 times over the last year, and it hasn't happened yet. And there's a fair ways still to go in all of this campaigning. So I tragically suspect we may see something even more extreme from him. And I think you raise the issue of funding. I think that's absolutely central to all of this with Trump, that he is so independently wealthy that he doesn't have to go chasing the campaign dollar in the way that many of his opponents do. And so it gives him license to go out there and say the kind of crazy things that he has been in the last few months. The Cruz and Rubio and Carson and these others are having to calibrate their responses according to various audiences they're trying to raise money amongst. Trump doesn't have that kind of limitation, so he's on his own here.
Phil, let's assume for a moment that Donald Trump doesn't end up as the nominee, the Republican nominee. He's been asked a couple of times to guarantee that he wouldn't run as an independent. I'm not sure that we could necessarily take any of those promises too seriously. And if he did, as you say, independently wealthy, it's not like he needs to go out and campaign for the funds to run this himself. And a third-party Donald Trump candidate could easily carve out 25% of the vote.
There's no doubt, and it may force basically a split in the Republican vote, that we may see a whole bunch of people who otherwise would have voted Republican sort of shifting even further to the right to vote to Trump, which would decimate the Republicans as a party and perhaps open up an even sort of more extreme right-wing fringe. We've seen a bit of that with the Tea Party, but I think Trump's numbers at the moment suggest that he's making this even more extreme on that side of the political spectrum. So the thing that I always thought about Trump was that this whole sort of presidential candidacy was a bit of a lark, that he was doing this to kind of, you know, self-aggrandize, raise publicity for himself and his kind of business interests. And I wonder if he hasn't slightly been caught off guard by his popularity over the last few months, that he was probably quite willing to bail out, back in July.
He's deliberately trying to implode his own campaign.
He almost has, and that he actually never had serious pretensions to the presidency anyway. And so he has another reason to have complete license. He has has his funding sort of on the one hand, and he has this, you know, kind of a complete maverick spirit, and he doesn't feel even responsible for the things that he's saying. So the fact that he's still out in front now perhaps has caught him off guard and is extremely frightening.
Roger, what does it say about the current mindset of many ordinary people in America that a candidate for president, a leading candidate for president at the moment, can say, let's ban all Muslims from the country, is condemned by the political establishment, but as a lot of people who've written about his speech have said, it's like they didn't hear the audience whooping and cheering when he said it.
Mm. Yeah, I think it does go back to terror, you know, and the fear of terror and the fear of the National Guard, you know, falling down. I mean, that's to say America being caught off guard. And I think, I don't know, it seems to me Trump has done certain things. He's basically totally eclipsed Jeb Bush and therefore has fulfilled one of the demands of probably of voters, which is that the presidential election shouldn't become a dynastic contest between Hillary and Bush. So that's a useful function for many voters. I mean, I'm trying to think who could rationally support Trump. Yeah. So it would be presumably the people against the dynasty. It would be people who wanted, I suppose, a sense of America first, no multinationalism, no multilateralism, which sort of slightly removes a couple of the Republican contenders. It's also somebody who's pitted basically against any kind of multicultural essence to the United States, and that's an awful lot of people still in the United States, and this is what the message you're getting from Trump is, that really he wants a country that puts business first, that puts America first, but is not willing to go out and risk American lives for it. That already, you know, that's already substantially different from Rubio. It's quite similar to Ted Cruz. So my feeling is either Trump burns out and Cruz mops up, or Trump, you know, carries on,
sails into the White House,
but fails.
He plays very well with a certain element in the Republican base who like to hear the messages that Donald Trump spreads, but American presidential elections are always turn on a sixpence, as they used to say. They're always very, very tight elections. And presumably, if you were a Democrat strategist at this point, Phil, you'd be thinking it was Christmas every day.
Oh, they must be rubbing their hands with glee. And given all the controversy around Clinton and, you know, second email accounts and a history of suspicion, you know, her and Bill and, you know, all of these kinds of issues. Hillary hasn't had to really answer for any of this in the last couple of months. I think that her campaign were on a defensive footing from the start, thinking, my goodness, you know, every brickbat under the sun is going to be thrown at us. And quite to the contrary, they've had totally clear sailing so far. And that's also not good for American democracy. I mean, what we're also not seeing is the Democrats having to, you know, really fight each other on any substantive point. That the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton show has been put in the shadows. We haven't had a serious public debate between the two of them yet, although their time will come. Obviously, the spotlight, I'm sure, will switch to them in the next couple of months. But it does mean at the moment the Democrats can basically just sit back and let the Republicans beat each other to a pulp in the view that they will win this election quite comfortably, whatever lunatic the Republicans put up next year.
Roger.
I think what Americans or some American voters value in Trump is that he's what they see as a truth teller. You know, you get this in Europe too, you know, that people will vote for Farage or for Marine Le Pen because they're speaking the unspeakable. They're breaking out against political correctness. They're naming, you know, they're calling a spade or, you know, all these cliches. And it feeds into this idea that there's a main media conspiracy which is trying to put their candidates into power. And the only way you can break through that is to go out for a man who just speaks his own mind. And if he's rubbish, then it's because the mainstream media is rubbishing him. And I think it's just that. It's just this absolute reflex, conspiratorial reflexes that are being pushed.
What's fascinating on that point, I think, is that that was exactly the rationale many people voted for Bush back in the early 2000s. Mm. But even Bush looks like a statesman compared to Trump. I mean, we have reached the absolute extreme of this anti-politically correct kind of politics. That this did not seem imaginable 10, 15 years ago. We've reached something that we've never seen before with Trump.
Let's just briefly imagine the bright sunlit uplands of a Trump-free political landscape. If you were at the top of the Republican Party, and quite clearly the people at the top of the Republican Party think that this is the opportunity to push him off the cliff and try and get this over with and move on, and you're thinking about how you rebuild post-Trump to try and win in less than a year, so what do you do?
It's really tough. I think he's sucked so much oxygen out of the entire Republican debate that I think what the Republicans would have to do is firstly moderate their tone on issues of immigration and Islam and the rest of it. There would be relationships with key constituencies in the U.S. that would have to be rebuilt, but that's going to take time. But my sense is that, you know, come February, even if Trump is out of the landscape, his shadow is going to hang over this. He's had 6 or 7 months to absolutely dominate the airwaves. He is now synonymous, I think, with the whole Republican presidential campaign. So whoever, let's, you know, hope to the highest heavens that whoever defeats him in on the Republican side is still going to have to answer to him and his constituency in some shape or form. So he's going to continue to dominate this debate, even if he's not the Republican candidate after February.
Well, let's take a short break before we move on to some other topics. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Next, we will discuss the modern etiquette of the hard-hitting political interview.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests this evening, Dr. Phil Clark from SOAS at the University of London and Roger Boys from The Times. Now, in the early days of television, political leaders were treated with the kind of reverence that you would reserve today for elderly royals. Where once we used to ask if ministers could spare a moment or two to enlighten our viewers about current affairs of state, things are now very different. Here is the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, being interviewed by Lee Sales on the ABC's flagship programme, 7:30.
Is there a risk that this issue could turn into a running sore for you the way that, say, Craig Thompson turned into for Julia Gillard?
Well, Lee, again, I'm sorry you've lost interest in innovation.
There's and, lots of issues is, we can walk and chew gum at the same that, time.
No, well, the problem is we can't.
If every guest on the program came on and they only got to talk about what they wanted to talk about, it would be a very different program.
Let me ask you this question. How interested do you think
I ask the your audience on this program? I think they're very interested,
do you think they're more interested in innovation and jobs?
I'll tell you what I think they're interested in. One of your colleagues resigning from the Liberal Party to join the National Party, Ian McFarlane, a number of your colleagues have criticised him, including the Attorney General George Brandis, who says it's left a bad taste in people's mouth. Mm-hmm.
And who hasn't dreamed of talking to a Prime Minister like that? Malcolm Turnbull was there to talk about a new $1 billion innovation package. He was, as you heard, not happy to be asked about problems with the government's national broadband network. Phil, I mean, it was all quite good natured and quite amiable, and it was still quite good natured and quite amiable afterwards. Prime ministerial interviews don't tend to be on single topics. They tend to range across a number of things. That's just how they are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think this says a huge amount about Turnbull as an individual, but also the Liberal Party as a whole, that they've gotten so used to compliant journalists who will ask all of the softball questions. And the minute that Turnbull is confronted with a journalist who asks him something difficult, he completely goes to water. A lot of this has to do with the general media atmosphere in Australia at the moment. We've had a Conservative government now for the last 4 or 5 years. The Murdoch press has given them a completely free ride. Turnbull, when he was a minister, I think got very used to turning up to interviews with the Murdoch press, basically with the script already written. And the ABC in Australia, which had the interview that you've just heard, has been one of the very few media outlets to try and hold this government accountable. When Tony Abbott was Prime Minister, he was on this witch hunt against the ABC and said that they were this kind of lunatic, you know, left-wing communist media outlet that was, you know, trying to bring the country down and, you know, it was sort of anti-Australian. So there's also in the background to all of this a fight between the ABC and this current government. And I think Lee Sales was kind of channeling some of that in her fairly tough questioning of Turnbull, shall we say.
Well, Roger, by contrast with the way Tony Abbott was you know, effectively went to war with the ABC and has cut its budget, and it's one of those situations where the government directly controls how much money the ABC gets to spend, and so if you get on the wrong side of the government, you're in some financial difficulty. Actually, if you watch the entire interview, it's 14 minutes or so, and as, you know, having watched many British political interviews, it all seems terribly polite, actually, for all of that I asked the questions thing. By contrast with the kind of grilling that British politicians get, and what you think of as a fairly sort of robust journalism style in Australia, it was still quite convivial.
Yeah, when you think of Paxman, for example, talking to Michael Howard, how many times did he rephrase that question?
I believe
question?
It's 17 times. We should
between 17 and 19.
This is a legendary interview between Jeremy Paxman on the BBC and the then Home Secretary, later leader of the Conservative Party, Michael Howard, in which it turned on the issue of not whether he had overruled the man in charge of Britain's prisons, but whether he had exceeded his powers by threatening to overrule him. He asked him the same question 17 times. Paxman subsequently said it was because he couldn't think of anything else to say. And there is, we were discussing a mild swearing alert. Jeremy Paxman is famously misattributed to him that he conducted his interviews from the standpoint, why is this lying bastard lying to me? Whereas he actually said in a speech to journalism students that that's precisely what you shouldn't do, is that you should start from the presumption that they're going to tell the truth. Now, Roger, combative political interviews are something that all politicians expect. Where do you earn the right to become combative? How far down the line do you allow the politician to spin their line before you start trying to hold them to account?
Well, I mean, if we go back to the Paxman question, I mean, how many people remember what the question was anymore? You know, how many people remember the substance? Oh, I mean, they probably deduce from that they didn't get an answer to that question, but they won't remember the question either. And I think that, actually, I have some sympathy with Turnbull, not just because I work for a newspaper that's owned by Rupert Murdoch, by the way, but also, I mean, I remember going to Blair, for example. I was based in Berlin. I went to Blair, south of Germany. He was having a conversation with Hans Küng, one of the great philosophers of our time, about morality and politics. And all the lobby reporters wanted to know was about some measure that had just come out about arresting hoodies who and forcing them to go to a cash machine and pay fines instantly on the spot. So you know, 1.5 hours of stuff about morality was just thrown out of the window for a brief headline about arresting hoodies, and I at that moment I had sympathy with Blair because I thought, well, you know, geez, the guy's got something interesting to say, important to say. He wants to communicate it. He's a politician trying to show that he's thinking a bit like a statesman, and he's being ambushed, yeah? So, I mean, sorry, I'm going a little bit against my profession here, but it's and that's what I felt a little bit with Turnbull. But, you know, Turnbull's a lawyer. He's smart enough to deal with these things by himself. He doesn't need to be babied through this situation. But the truth is, actually, that innovation package was interesting, yeah? And And the defection wasn't very interesting. So, you know, and it was, as I say, with the Paxman thing, it was similar. The question was interesting, but we never got an answer. And it wasn't that interesting for the viewers to make a gladiatorial contest of it. So I think more there has to be more subtlety and less entertainment value, maybe, in the way that politicians are grabbed around the neck.
Let's briefly move on to a couple of other topics. In Venezuela, the leader of the country's opposition says it has won a two-thirds majority in elections at the weekend. Now, if that's confirmed, it would give Enrique Pérez's alliance the power to make sweeping changes to legislation and theoretically challenge appointments made by the president, Nicolas Maduro. Phil, in a lot of countries like the US, this situation, one party has the presidency, the other has the parliament, will be seen, in America, for example, as legislative gridlock. In Venezuela, it's almost feels a bit like refreshing democracy.
It does, and I think the Venezuelan voters have thought exactly that, that after years and years of Chavez and his party, that it's time for a change. It's going to, I think, be very, very difficult for Maduro, Chavez's successor, in the next few months, because with the opposition winning as many seats as they have, they can effectively turf him out. Not only can they make his life difficult in the parliament, they probably have the numbers now to call for his head. So I think there's going to be big change there. The very interesting thing for me, though, is to see what kind of replacement economic policy the opposition puts in place. The population's obviously fed up with food shortages and queues at hospitals and pharmacies and the rest of it. The opposition have made really big claims about turning the economy around, increasing employment and sort of stocking the supermarket shelves again. That's going to be easier said than done. This is a very volatile electorate, and I think if the opposition don't deliver on that very, very quickly, they could find themselves in a similar position to Chavez's party, i.e. turfed out on their ear.
Now, Roger, is this going to be a hiccup for Mr. Maduro? Is this the beginning of a proper kind of multi-party system? Or is this just a temporary blip?
Well, I think Phil's right. It's a question of how the opposition plays it now. It's got to really focus on the economics of it all. I mean, you know, people not getting antibiotics, you know, there are queues for babies' nappies. You know, the whole place is in complete meltdown, just, you know, economically dysfunctional. So they've got to get a grip on that, and they've got to be careful about it too, because privatizations, for example, which is part of their program, will probably push the Maduroists, give them reason to crack down and so on. So in this case, I would actually advocate a cautious counter-revolution, rather than, even though my sympathy is to get rid of these populist governments throughout, these left-wing populist governments, which are really dragging their countries down. I still think that the opposition now has to be to use this new power very intelligently and very carefully, and stick to economic issues, stick to economic supply issues, and economic management issues. Open up for business a bit more, and just create a better life for Venezuelans, and then focus on getting rid of Maduro. I think it's just got to be done in that order.
I just want to very briefly talk about Beijing. It's been described by some creative headline writers as the apocalypse. The first ever pollution red alert shut down much of the Chinese capital in an attempt to ease pollution that is 10 times above global safe levels. Timing couldn't be much worse for China. I'm going to have to get very brief views from both of you, but coming in the middle of a global climate change conference, if you're trying to grow your economy but your citizens have to stay indoors, things aren't quite right, are they?
It's staggering, actually, that China even demanded this shutdown in the middle of the conference. I mean, given it's a government that seems in control of the message, shall we say, it's a wonder they didn't wait until the climate change conference was over to do this. It shows how bad it must be in Beijing.
I mean, Roger, when you're saying we've got the fastest growing economy in the world, but we're also dependent on coal and choking smog.
Yeah, absolutely. It's cold coal. It's the north of China. You know, it's not the whole of China. It's part of China. And so, but Chinese, because it's all state media and all these things, they haven't managed to get the message right. So everyone's focused on one or two absolutely smogged up cities, whereas actually south of China is basically all right. I mean, it's about as smogged up as London.
Well, to those of you listening on breathing masks, you have our sympathy. We'll have to leave it there. Roger Boyce and Dr. Phil Clark, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Hanukov. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. For the next half hour, it'll be Bill Luty. He keeps you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900, Josh Fennett is here with our design programme Section D. Later at 2200 London time, it's the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for now, goodbye and thank you very much for listening.